First from Mr. Hanshu.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Eric Hanshu on behalf of appellant Eugene Belair. The district court erred when it instructed the jury in this case that SORNA required Mr. Belair to register at or about places that he temporarily stayed for 7 days or more. The SORNA statute at 16913, section 16913, makes clear what the registering requirements are. Those requirements are that a sex offender must register where they reside, where they work, and where they attend school.
And you objected to that?
Yes, Your Honor. And we objected both pretrial as well as at the jury charging conference with the court, as well as with the instruction itself when it was provided. And then throughout the trial, Your Honor, we objected to this instruction.
Did the government give a response to the objection?
Yes, Your Honor. When they proposed the instruction, they cited to the SMART guidelines as the basis for this, for the authority for this instruction. And then at the time of trial and arguments, their response again was to fall back on the DOJ SMART guidelines as being the authority for this proposition of purported law, Your Honor. And so their response has been, and I'll address that briefly, that per the guidelines and per section 16914, they were allowed to, the Attorney General's office, I should say, was permitted and authorized to provide further requirements on jurisdictions. But if you look closely at what that SMART guideline is, it's exactly that. It's a instruction to jurisdictions as part of implementing SORNA as information to be required.
Had Texas adopted that requirement?
No, Your Honor. In fact, as we indicated in our brief in one of the footnotes, neither Texas or New York have implemented SORNA. In fact, they've both indicated New York, absolutely, that they will not implement SORNA. And Texas, through congressional records, has indicated, the state congressional records, that they, in essence, plan not to adopt it as well, implement it due to primarily, I believe, costs issues, Your Honor. So neither of the states involved in this case have implemented SORNA. And if you look at the instruction, what happened in this case and why I think the harm is obvious is that you had two alternative theories. You had a theory that Mr. Belair had changed his residence. That was a legally proper theory as per 16913. You then had what I call this gap-filling, last-minute instruction that was provided to the court a week before trial. In fact, the district court in pretrial arguments indicated it would not accept this instruction. And then at the close of evidence, the district court turned its decision 180 degrees and then instructed on this. And as you saw in the record in this case, throughout the closing argument, now with this instruction in hand, the government solicited and urged the jury to find Mr. Belair guilty on this temporary stay instruction.
So the theory that you say is acceptable is the government had to prove that he didn't leave within 3 days after deciding, or rather that he had decided 3 days before he was found present in the state, that he had moved there permanently.
Yeah, so the government's, our defense in attacking the government's case is that this case was about whether he changed residence. It should have been a simple case in terms of the legal rules to be followed. And then we look to what is the evidence that he changed his residence. And
right, but the key thing was he had to have decided at least 3 days He had to remain at least 3 days after he decided that he was going to move there permanently. Isn't that what the element of the offense is?
Right. If the jury were to be considering only, and the government had not argued based on this illegal theory, then the theory, the proper theory would have been whether or not he changed his residence. And if he changed his residence, he would have then been required to register that change within 3 days. And so at trial, as we noted in defense, the government provided little evidence in terms of the normal indicia of when an individual changes their residence. When an individual changes residence, you normally have, for example, associated documents for applying for new identifications, new phone numbers, forwarding, mail forwarding, moving boxes, new leases. None of that was present in this case. In fact, the government relied essentially, in essence, on the testimony of the two Customs and Border officials at the New York Port of Entry in a 20-minute dialogue with Mr. Belair.
He did tell the Border Patrol agent that he was living with his girlfriend in New York, right?
According to their testimony, said he was living there, but he also, during this same discussion, when asked about this initially, said he had gone to New York. He left El Paso, Texas, to New York to visit this girlfriend to see whether or not this was a place that, you know, he would be able to and want to move to.
And he said he was looking for a job.
He had indicated, according to their testimony, he said he was looking for a job, but they provided no information as to what jobs he was looking at in this particular case.
And he said his girlfriend's boss was helping him try to find a job.
Right. And in the record, you'll see pretrial, the U.S. Marshal actually submitted declaration before the trial started that they had further statement that same individual, Mr. Stuart White, disclaimed Mr. Belair having said he would move there. That was offered before the trial started as a last-minute discovery production. And so the only testimony you had was that he had gone there with no, he left El Paso with no intention of moving to New York. His intention was simply to visit and to see if that was a place where he would want to move in the future. Additionally, you have a statement from him that says, and he had to move there because he still had to go back to El Paso to get his belongings and move.
But wouldn't you agree that a jury could infer from the fact that he's looking for a job and he has his girlfriend's boss helping him find a job that he wanted to stay?
But the question would be then, when did he decide he wanted to stay, one? And two, when is there evidence showing the culmination of that decision of wanting to stay there? And there wasn't, Your Honor. The CBP officers in this case, in fact, expressly said they never asked that. And why did they never ask that? Well, because their research into trying to determine what Mr. Belair's requirements was, them looking on the internet as to Texas state registration requirements, and them conferring with Texas officials as to what the state registration requirements. That is, I think, the flaw in what happened in their investigation and why they didn't have the evidence to address what the federal requirements were. They didn't even know what they were. And so they were satisfied after their 20-minute interview that, you know, he'd failed to comply with the requirements of Texas state.
Well, I'm just talking about what the jury heard.
Sure, and the jury heard that evidence about what it is they inquired in terms of what the requirements were, as well as a statement by them on cross-examination by myself that they did not know what the federal requirements
were. The jury also heard that he was looking for a job and he had his girlfriend's boss helping him find a job.
Correct, Your Honor. And they also, in terms of, you know, looking at that, I think what also should be addressed, though, is the government's reliance on, because what the jury did hear loud and clear throughout the closing in this case is the government's argument and reliance upon this improper theory. And in fact, they begged this jury to find him guilty on that 7-day theory. And so that's why when you're looking at the analysis under the harm and errors that this court, I believe, is addressing related to Skilling case, it makes clear in there is to look at the totality and also the arguments by the government. We have the Jackson case where this court has said that reliance upon particular and closing arguments of the government on impermissible evidence, and in this case jury instruction, is harmful. And you have that. You have that not only in the opening of the closing argument, but then in the rebuttal. You have it in the record at 568, 572, 583, and 84. the prosecutor in this case repeatedly urging and asking the jurors to consider and find Mr. Bello guilty looking at this 7-day requirement.
What relief are you seeking here?
We're asking the court to vacate the judgment against Mr. Bello, Your Honor.
Well, what, you want a new trial, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
I'm confused because your brief says dismiss the indictment with prejudice, but there's no basis for that, is there?
Well, and I think that just related to the issues that we preserved in terms of the constitutional challenges, Your Honor. And so as it relates to those, we'd ask, and we understand those are foreclosed by Fifth Circuit argument. So, but as it relates to the challenge here in front of this court on these jury instructions is to vacate and reverse this for a new trial with an instruction to the district court that this 7-day theory is impermissible and not the law, clearly as stated by SORNA, Your Honor. And I think that's made clear. I mean, again, when you look at what the government's response in this case in terms of their support for this proposition, it is simply a directive to jurisdictions. And I think in looking at this, I know that this court itself and all of its members have repeatedly looked at the SORNA statute, discussed the purposes of it and the mechanisms of it, as well as the Carr court did and broke this down, which are, this is a registering scheme that has as a component of it the penalty provision, but it's largely a registering scheme that's a work between the state and the federal government. And so you have in this case clearly the directive by the federal government as to when you have to register an update and the places you do that. And absent from that is any directive in the statute to register at places you temporarily visit. And the reason for that is to have this interplay in SORNA between federal law enforcement and registration and state. You look at a case like this, this is a case where the state registration requirements and such could just as easily been prosecuted against Mr. Belair, and that's something that, frankly, the federal government and the state authorities work out themselves. I can tell this court I had a trial recently on this exact same issues in El Paso, and the district court rejected this 7-day theory. They proceeded on then simply the 3-day change of residence theory. The judge found the not guilty, and the state, Texas state authorities in El Paso immediately picked up that prosecution and are pursuing it right now. And that's,
I think we have that point, Mr. Hanshew. You have anything else?
I have nothing further, Your Honor, at this point, other than rebuttal.
We have some time left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by, I think, narrowing this court's focus, if I may, to what I believe are the relevant issues in this case. If you look at our brief, specifically the section where it sets forth the actual jury instruction that was given, and I believe that's on page 42 of our brief, essentially the jury was required to find and only could convict if it found that, quote, a person cannot be found guilty of failing to register as required by federal law unless he resided in a new state, in this case New York, for at least 3 days without registering.
I'm not finding that.
Excuse me, on page 25, Your Honor.
25. Okay.
I misspoke.
Okay, excuse me, go ahead.
So it's bolded there in the middle of the page. So first, the jury cannot find a person guilty of failing to register, in this case, unless he resided in New York for at least 3 days without registering. And then the very last sentence, straddling page 25 and 26, the government must prove that the defendant left the residence listed in the registry, El Paso, with no intention of returning. Now, you'll notice that nowhere does the requirement for registration of temporary address appear in that instruction. More than anything, this section that follows simply addresses the concept of resides. But in this case, the evidence the jury heard, and what Mr. Belair doesn't want to focus on is that the jury necessarily had to find these elements regardless of any argument about the seven-day rule. The jury could not convict.
It's not unusual, though, that either in a civil or criminal case, the prosecution or the plaintiff would present alternate theories. I mean, you know, the court gives a charge on theory number one, and then he says the law also requires this for theory number two. I mean, I don't see why just because he gave the elements of your first theory that precludes reading that charge is giving the jury another option.
In fact, but the fact is that it has to find the elements of the first properly charged moving offense in order to convict of the second. And under the harmless error standard, if the government proves and the jury has to find the correct legal theory, there's no error if you have a second erroneous legal theory, which we're not conceding that it is. But here the jury had to find it. This court presumes the jury follows its instructions, and the argument of counsel isn't anything other than argument. And
where was the jury told it must find both?
Right here. It was never told that it had to find anything about a temporary address. And so specifically under this third section, there's three elements that have to be proven. The jury is instructed that they have to find, cannot be found guilty unless you find that he resided in the state of New York for 3 days without registering, and that he went there, he left El Paso with no intention of returning. And the evidence of his no intention of returning is overwhelming. He buys a one-way ticket. He then goes a couple of days later to the El Paso registry, never mentions that he's going to Vermont. He then goes to Vermont. He starts looking for work. He basically confesses. His immigration card, when he attempts to reenter the United States, states his address is in New York. He doesn't list El Paso as his address. The evidence that he essentially moved there was overwhelming. It is detailed extensively in our brief, and it was, he specifically asked, where are you living? Quote, I'm living in Moria, New York. The prosecutor, Belair, did not say he was living in El Paso and I went to visit New York. He said, I'm living in New York.
Yeah, as human, you've made that point. I mean, let's focus on this paragraph on page 26 of your brief under registration of temporary address. Now, you're contending that that statement, that paragraph, is absolutely accurate and correct? It's one sentence, I guess.
The law, the provision that says the law also requires, and this is the sticky wicket that I think the defense would like to see this court wander into. And our reading of SORNA is that necessarily you have to have state law be a gap filler to provide these various components and definitions. In this case, however, I don't believe the court needs to reach that issue because the conviction...
Well, whether we reach it or not, I ask you a question, and it's really a yes or no question. Does the government take the position that that sentence is absolutely correct?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. And we base that on, essentially, SORNA contemplates that, in accordance with the Attorney General's SMART provisions, that you will gap fill the registration requirements with state law. And that is...
What state law are you using to fill the gap?
In this case, Texas law, Your Honor.
But Texas hadn't adopted this, as I understand it.
Well, as a definition, in other words, clearly the scheme requires that the gaps be filled using determined law after the fact. And admittedly, this is a very unclear area of whether and how, which form applies, which doesn't. And even if you assume that the argument or the instruction was erroneous, in this case, the government's position is that it had no effect on the jury's verdict.
Let me ask you this. I mean, to me, the government's argument belies the fact that it was not relying on this one sentence as an alternate theory. The government said I think this is a quote, the government submits the evidence is was sufficient to convict the defendant of failing to update the registration, dash, being gone 7 days without returning.
That's
now,
correct, Your Honor.
That sounds to me like you're telling the jury you can convict him just on that proof.
Well, actually, if you look at it, and admittedly at several different points, you can pick different passages where it's somewhat confusing. For example, the argument on record page 584, the government submits that there is sufficient evidence in this case to convict the defendant of failing to update his registration as required to under federal law when he left on the 11th or the 13th of August for New York with no intent to return, but much less being gone for more than 7 days without returning. What the government really was attempting to do here was prove up that he had no intention of returning when he left and essentially was making that point. Now, was it at points inartful and perhaps went too far? I think that we could clearly say that the main thrust and the instructions that the court gave to the jury required it to convict only on that one moving without failing to inform within the requisite period of time. Now, the instruction that is listed there is more of a definition, and admittedly, it's not tied to anything. It doesn't have a provision that requires the jury to find anything. It's simply this instruction that's hanging there. In retrospect, as an appellate person, I would say it would have been preferable for it not to have been there, in all honesty. But the judge included it, and so the question now is, do we have error that requires that his conviction be vacated and remanded for a new trial?
Wouldn't the sentence that I read to you, though, indicate that the government was proceeding on this theory as one ground for conviction?
Even if there are two theories, in this case, the jury was obligated to find all of the elements of the properly charged improved theory. Therefore, any error on the other theory is harmless under this court's review of jury charge error. Because in this case, and I believe, and we've detailed in our brief, the evidence that he moved from which the jury could find that he left without the intention of returning was very strong.
It wasn't overwhelming, though. I mean, I can see where a jury could find that he wanted to move to New York, and he was going to move to New York if he could find a job. But that I don't think that would make out your case.
But that contrasts with his own confession that he did, in fact, reside in New York, that he was looking for a job. He bought a one-way ticket. He failed. He made inconsistent statements when he reported his El Paso registry information. He never even mentioned to them that he had bought a ticket. And then later made a statement that was conflicting about whether he had any intentions at the time when he registered. He said he didn't know that he was going to New York, but in fact he'd already bought a ticket. So the jury had ample evidence.
Oh, there was sufficient evidence, but that's not the question. I mean,
it
has to be absolutely overwhelming. And how could you say that a reasonable juror could not have believed that this guy was going to move to New York if he could find a job?
And in this case, assuming for sake of argument that we have multiple theories, which I think at times the government seemed to argue one area and did move into, at least in a limited basis, some references to this short-term stay, this court employs an analysis to look at whether the error is reversible. And in this case, we believe that the evidence is quite strong. And finally, just looking at the Attorney General's SMART directives implemented by the states, and obviously, Congress expressly contemplated that the Attorney General would further define the obligations of both states and the registrants themselves. It indicated as much in the section immediately following in section 16914, information required in registration, both in A, it says, provided by the offender, which states the sex offender shall provide the following information to the appropriate official for inclusion in the sex offender registry, and B, provide the jurisdiction, which states, and so essentially, we believe that the SMART guidelines do incorporate definitions under state law. However, in this case, I'm not even sure why the instruction was necessary. The judge decided to give it, and in this case, I think the jury was given no avenue by the instructions to act on it. It sits there by itself with no mandatory provision. But,
it's sitting there with the government's argument, too, and that's another thing we need to look at.
And the jury is presumed to follow its instructions, and the argument of counsel is not evidence, and it doesn't defeat the court's charge, certainly. And the charge specifically says the jury has to find that he left with the intention of not returning. They cannot convict, even with this other provision, unless they honor that. And interestingly enough, that's exactly what defense counsel argued to the jury himself during the closing argument.
But when you have an instruction that begins with the words, the law requires, surely the jury is going to take that seriously and look at it carefully to see whether the defendant failed to live up to that requirement.
In context of the entire instruction, which we read as a whole, certainly it does not defeat the provision that was previously stated that sets forth that the government must prove and a person cannot be found guilty unless those provisions essentially form the undisputed two elements of the offense that the government believes were properly proven beyond a reasonable doubt in this case and the jury could properly find. And on balance, the argument is that we don't need to get into all of these other things because the alternative theory, even if it was improper, and even if it shouldn't have been argued, the jury necessarily had to find that he left without an intent to return before they could convict on the erroneous theory. So where we have a properly pleaded theory and proof to sustain it, the alternative theory is simply harmless and did not contribute to the conviction in this case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kay. All right, back to you, Mr. Henshaw.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, briefly address a couple of the comments from the government. One of the comments was not sure why the instruction was there. Well, the instruction was there because they filed it, requested it, and argued for it to be there with the district court. So the proposition that somehow the district court came up with this instruction of its own and it just ended up in there by chance is flatly contradicted by the record. Then the government talks about now how this instruction is somehow a outlier and it's not necessary to the findings of the jury. Well, their own brief actually at page 45 reads, thus, whether a sex offender has actually changed residences, any change of 7 days or more, regardless of the sex offender's intent to remain at the location, triggers reporting requirements. Their own argument contradicts what they're stating here today and what they've said in other parts of their brief. They have argued and they had the court instruct as a matter of law that the law also required registration at places you temporarily visit. So they themselves have already conceded to their own argument is that it's a standalone basis and a theory. And that is coupled with their argument to the jury at various locations in the record at 562, 572, 583, 584, where they invoked that 7-day instruction and asked and solicited for a finding of guilt against Mr. Belair on that basis and that basis alone. It's clear in the record, it's uncontradicted, Your Honors. And lastly, I would point out and leave what the jury in this case was left with, which is the federal courthouse in El Paso is a brand new courthouse. It's filled with technology. And standing behind me when I had this closing argument is a ginormous flat screen television monitor with the U.S. attorney put at the end was that instruction. You'll see in the record my objection to, again, this is Texas state law, and that is what the jury was left with. They weren't left with these other alternate theories. It wasn't just an outlier. It wasn't something that wasn't relied on. It was something that was presented, argued, and put up there for this jury to look at that screen and look at in their monitors in front of them to find Mr. Belair guilty, Your Honors. So we'd ask that the court find this instruction improper and reverse and vacate this for a new trial.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. We have your case.